I'm Marty Moscowen, and this is Radio Times in Review, our weekly show when we go back into our archives and highlight some of the best conversations from Radio Times past. On today's show, we're going to bring you some of the familiar NPR voices you hear on WHYY and who have been guests on Radio Times. We'll hear from veteran NPR reporter Susan Stamberg, who joined us in 2014 for a special member event held at WHYY to talk about her long career in radio. We'll also hear from Morning Edition host Steve Inskeep, who was our guest when we took Radio Times on the road last summer. We discuss his book, Jacksonland, President Andrew Jackson, Cherokee Chief John Ross, and a great American land grab. But first, we'll hear my conversation with longtime NPR reporter and commentator Cokie Roberts. That's all coming up when Radio Times in Review continues after the news from NPR. This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscowen. On today's edition of the show, we're going to listen to my conversations with some of the most familiar people in public radio. We begin by listening to my discussion with longtime NPR reporter and weekly commentator Cokie Roberts. She joined me last year to discuss her book, Capital Dames, The Civil War and the Women of Washington. The book tells the stories of the sisters, wives, and others who worked behind the scenes during one of the most tumultuous times in American history. Many of these women went on to change the country as suffragists, journalists, activists, and philanthropists. Let's listen.
Was there a Rosie the Riveter of the American
Yes,
Civil War?
Yes, absolutely. There were women who worked in the arsenals, and it was very dangerous work. They were stuffing cartridges and making ammunition. And in Washington, in fact, there was a horrible explosion at the arsenal, and a couple of dozen very young women were killed. And the newspaper accounts of the tragedy are horrendous. They're the day after the explosion. They're uncovering the charred bodies, which are unrecognizable. One was recognized by her shoes. But the reporter also commented on their hoop skirts and how they were trapped in their hoop skirts. So here are these women off to do this dangerous, stiflingly hot work, and they're dressed properly as mid-century proper ladies. It was a huge, huge funeral led by President Lincoln and Secretary of War Stanton, where thousands of people turned out to honor these women who had worked so hard for the war effort.
It was so interesting to read about the number of women who worked in government.
I mean, right.
Essentially, the men had either gone off to war or gone off to some, you know, version of the war, and they filled the jobs.
It was very interesting. They started showing up in Washington to make a living. You know, the men had gone off. But they showed up just as Congress passed a law permitting the printing of paper money to pay for the war. And money still comes off of the press in these great huge sheets, right? And, of course, now it's cut into bills by machines. Then it was cut by hand with scissors. And the treasurer of the United States, General Skinner, said women are just better with scissors than men are. And, of course, we can pay them a lot less, which is something NPR has always felt as well. But the fact is
oh, that interesting. You digress.
Right, I digress. They came into government in large numbers. And at the end of the – later in his life, General Skinner said that that was one of the smartest things he had done, was to bring women into government. And by the end of the war, one of the journalists, of whom there were also quite a few – said that there were women of education in every department of government. And of course, they didn't go home.
I was going to say that was my next question, whether, sort of like World War II, whether they went home or whether
stayed. There's a myth that everybody went home in World War II. And some people, of course, did go home, and there were women displaced by men coming back. But keep in mind, 60,000 women took advantage of the GI Bill after World War II. You don't think about that. And that's led us to where we are today, with the majority of college graduates being female, the vast majority of graduate school graduates being female. That all started with the war.
You wrote, and I scribbled this down because I did not know this, that there were no female nurses at the time of the
right.
Civil War.
It was just not women's work. But women, of course, nursed at home all the time, and plantation mistresses nursed everybody on the plantation. But it was not official. And so Dorothea Dix, who is really someone, you know, you think you know about her, but most people, I would argue, probably do not. She was, of course, this advocate for the mentally ill, but she was so influential that before the war, the Senate gave her an office in the Capitol from which to do her lobbying. And she was lobbying for the federal government to put aside 12 million acres for the poor and the mentally ill. She got the bill through both houses of Congress, but the president vetoed it, President Pierce. But she then showed up in Washington as the war began and became volunteered as the superintendent of female nurses. So women started nursing. There were only like three women doctors in the country at the time. And one of them, Mary Walker, did also show up in Washington to volunteer. She is still, Marty, the only female to have won the Medal of Honor.
Oh, fascinating.
Yes.
Fascinating. Well, there are many women in here that I found fascinating, including Verena Davis, the wife of Jefferson Davis. He was the president of the Confederacy. Type at all.
No. Although these women did describe themselves as belles, as you said earlier, and she was one of the belles in Washington before the war, vying for first place. But she was – here's the great thing. Women's letters are so much better than men's letters. You know, the men knew they were doing something that would probably get recorded and preserved and published, so they were very careful and pompous in their letters. The women just wrote letters, and so they're funny and frank and feisty and
gossipy,
wonderfully gossipy, and they've got tons of political news in them. But they also have fashion and who's all too often losing babies and the economic situation's all there. But she at one point wrote to her mother because one of the other belles, Adele Cutts, who was this beautiful, kind, smart girl. They were so young, you know, whom everybody loved. And she was Dolly Madison's great niece. So she had a position, even though no man in her life did. But she was about to marry Stephen Douglas. And Verena Davis was furious that this was happening and wrote to her mother, "The dirty speculator and party trickster, broken in health by drink, with his first wife's money, buys an elegant, well-bred woman because she is poor and her father is proud." And then Verena says it's a good thing a new water system is coming to town so that sparing his wife's olfactories, Douglas may wash a little oftener. If he don't, his acquaintance will build larger rooms with more perfect ventilation. So we only know from woman that Stephen Douglas smelled bad.
He didn't take enough baths.
Right.
But she's very interesting because it does feel like she – I don't know if ambivalence is too strong a word, but she wasn't entirely behind the
Confederacy. I think ambivalence is an appropriate word. She wasn't behind it, and she didn't think it could succeed. She was clear-eyed about – what the manufacturing situation was, what the transportation situation was. She realized that this could not survive as a country on its own. But she did her duty as the First Lady of the Confederacy, and then after the war, she lobbied Andrew Johnson to get Jefferson Davis out of jail. He had been arrested in theory, as part of the Lincoln assassination plot, which was a crock, but he was in jail. And then they had a very difficult life. They have a tempestuous marriage. He's never able to really get a job and hold a job. They're separated at periods. And finally, he dies. And she moves to New York, much to the distress of the South, the First Lady of the Confederacy going to this Yankee place, right? But she had always sort of chafed against the Southern belle role, and she had never been sufficiently pale to be a true Southern belle. She was a little olive-complected. And so she wrote to her daughter when she was moving to New York and said, "I am free, brown, and 64. I can do whatever I want to do."
I like that as a bumper sticker, I think.
Exactly.
It would work perfectly.
And then when she moved to New York, she made her living writing for the New York World. But she befriended Julia Grant. And that, Marty, I think is so important because she understood that what she was doing was an act of reconciliation. It was page one news and all over the country when the two of them met. And then she went to the dedication of the Grant Memorial, all of this by way of trying to bring the country back together.
Were there questions about her olive skin? I mean, yes. Was that an issue at that time?
Yes, yes. I mean, and I don't know whether it was implied that there was anything, you know, mixed blood there. It's hard to imagine that because of the, because we know her, you know, her origins. Right. The big problem wasn't really the color. It was that her grandfather was governor of New Jersey.
Perish the thought. Right. But it's interesting to compare her to Mary Todd Lincoln.
There are a lot of similarities.
I was wondering about that.
She's a much more even-keeled person than Mary Todd Lincoln, who today we would probably call bipolar. But Mary Lincoln was from Kentucky, and the Northerners suspected her because she had many relatives in the Confederate Army. And then she lost a baby before they came to Washington, a two-year-old, and then her child Willie died in the White House. Verena Davis came from, you know, her grandfather from New Jersey. She was educated in Philadelphia, so there was a, you know, suspicion of her of not being Southern enough. And she had a baby die in Washington, a two-year-old, and then her 10-year-old was killed for a fall when he was in Richmond when she was First Lady. So they had many things in common. The difference was Verena Davis could pull herself together and do her duty. Mary Lincoln could not.
I mentioned Elizabeth Keckley in your book, and this she has been written about, but she's still an absolutely fascinating
she
character.
She is, and a lot of people, even though she has been written about, a lot of people don't know about her. She was a slave. She bought her freedom. She got to Washington. She was a very, very talented dressmaker, a couturier. And she made dresses for all the prominent women. And then when Mary Lincoln came to town, of course, she wanted the best. And so she hired Mrs. Keckley. And Mary Lincoln was not really liked by the women of Washington. She was a difficult person. And they didn't like the president. So it was, you know, an issue. She therefore befriended the people who worked for her, and Elizabeth Keckley became her closest confidant. She, Mrs. Keckley, took care of Mrs. Lincoln when Willie died. She took care of her after the president was shot, when Mary Lincoln stayed in the White House for a couple of months and was really out of her mind. And then Mrs. Keckley went with her to Illinois. And she had heard all of the conversations between the president and First Lady. They were not hidden. And Mary Lincoln also expressed her views without any kind of governor about the cabinet members and all of that. And Elizabeth Keckley then wrote a tell-all book, and just like people in the White House do now. And, of course, it totally destroyed the relationship, but it does give us quite an insight into the Lincoln White House.
You know, it's interesting to think about the Civil War. I think something like 2% of the American population died during that war.
More than 600,000 Americans lost their lives in the Civil War.
Yeah.
It is a horrible, horrible story. And obviously, the enormous good of the end of slavery came out of it. But what a failure of statesmanship that you had to go to war to achieve that end.
That was my 2015 conversation with NPR reporter and commentator Cokie Roberts about her book Capital Dames, The Civil War and the Women of Washington. When we get back from this short break, we'll hear my discussion with NPR's Morning Edition host Steve Inskeep about his book, Jacksonland. You're listening to Radio Times in Review on WHYY. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. On today's show, we're spending time with some of public radio's most recognizable people.
Every morning, NPR listeners hear Steve Inskeep anchor Morning Edition. But beyond his hosting duties, Inskeep is also an author and historian. His latest book discusses President Andrew Jackson and the battles over territory that now makes up a large part of the country. The book is called Jacksonland, President Andrew Jackson, Cherokee Chief John Ross, and a Great American Land Grab. This conversation took place at a WHYY member event held at Chestnut Hill College in June of last year. Let's take a listen.
Reading your book and even looking back on this time period, we're talking about the years between the Revolutionary and Civil War, it feels like this country was going through some kind of adolescence. It feels like a teenage country.
It is the moment when our country was taking or beginning to take the shape that we would recognize today, particularly our democracy. It was a republic from its early years. There was voting from the early years, but the democratic institutions and systems and traditions that we know so well didn't really exist until this period when they started to take shape, and my two characters had a lot to do with that.
Is this a book about real estate then?
Oh my goodness, yes. Yes. Isn't everything?
A fight over real estate.
It is a fight over real estate. People wanted land. There were poor white settlers who wanted to move west. And what we're talking about here is the Appalachians, the southern Appalachians. That was considered part of the West back then. There were poor white families who wanted to move west and get land. There were also entrepreneurs, as we could call them, who owned slaves and wanted to start giant plantations and grow cotton and make a lot of money. Or they had excess slaves in Virginia and didn't know what to do with them and wanted a place to sell them. And so there were multiple social and economic motivations to push westward into that land. And Andrew Jackson was not the guy who invented this movement. He was not the only person in favor of it, but he was an incredibly effective guy at getting it done and getting that real estate to change hands.
What I found so interesting, we know President Jackson and the Trail of Tears, but what I didn't know was that as a young man, he's a lawyer, he is amassing huge swaths of land. He is ripping off Indians. He is negotiating and helping out his friends and family.
Yeah, that was something that I didn't realize either. This is a guy who had multiple motives at once. He was a very clever strategic thinker. And there are lessons for us today because I think we're all like this just a little bit. I mean, you do things that you hope are in the community's interest, but they also are going to be in your economic self-interest. And you want to make sure you get the balance right and not go too far. This is a guy who was a general for many years before he was president, who believed in the vital importance of national security and securing this very unsettled area that was filled with Indian nations that were in many cases allied with the United States and in some cases not, that was still coveted by colonial powers, an area where Spain still controlled Florida. So he was thinking about securing it and getting it more firmly within the grasp of the United States, but he was also thinking about the land values, and you're absolutely right. I investigated this and discovered that Jackson and his friends personally obtained large chunks of former Cherokee land in the Tennessee River Valley, which Jackson, as a public official, he was still a public official, had obtained for the United States. And then he got his own hands on them and made a lot of money.
You say as well that he sort of symbolized or emblemized the country at that time, feeling a sense of entitlement.
Yeah, I think so. And let's say that he symbolized a part of the country because it was a diverse country with a lot of different opinions about what became known as manifest destiny. But there was this sense that the frontier was there for the taking, that it was available if you could just get the Indians out of the way.
Mm. So how we'll talk about John Ross. So how should we think about Andrew Jackson?
Wow. Well, I mean, people have such strong opinions.
They do.
They absolutely do. And that's the first thing to realize about this guy. He is someone who has been dead for 170 years, and people still feel as passionately about him as if he is still alive. I don't know that you're going to feel after reading this that he's any less of a monster, but I would like to think that you would discover that he is a more complicated and interesting person. He's a human being. He's a politician. He is a man who actually could have empathy for other people and who was loyal to his friends and was strategic and far-seeing and unbelievably persistent. A man who traveled around the United States through his political career and into the White House with two bullets in his body from his social interactions. And
You're going to have to explain
and
that, Steve.
I will explain that. Okay. I'll just finish my point by saying we can wish that he applied his incredible talent to better ends in many cases, and history has judged him to have made many mistakes. But he's an extraordinary individual.
And the two bullets? We can't let that go by.
Okay, of course not. Of course not. He was a general. He fought wars. He was not wounded in war. He was wounded in conversation. He was living in an era in which people challenged each other to duels. Often the duels were farces. They were frauds. But men, and it's just remarkable to think about that today, you think about like old style men as being very kind of quiet and unemotional, that kind of greatest generation thing. You go back before the greatest generation, and it's the men who are unbelievably unreasonable and incredibly sensitive.
I am shocked.
Yeah, I know. Because men are so different today. But anyway, there was an era when dueling was illegal, but it was common, at least a challenge to a duel. In 1806, Jackson became involved in a duel and resolved that rather than end it with a shot in the air or some face-saving solution, he was going to kill the man.
Wow.
And he knew the other man was a good shot, according to accounts of this duel. And so he resolved to let the other guy shoot first. And Jackson figured if he was still alive and standing after that other guy shot first, that Jackson would have all the time in the world to carefully aim and kill him. The other man fired, hit Jackson's chest. Somehow Jackson remained standing. In fact, he had an overcoat on, and his opponent even thought that he must have missed because Jackson was still standing. And he took his time, he aimed at the man, he pulled the trigger. The hammer of the gun did not quite go down, so he raised his weapon, cocked again, aimed again, and shot him.
Wow.
The man bled to death, and Jackson sent him a bottle of wine to comfort him in his final hours. This hurt his reputation because the guy was popular. I think if he'd been unpopular, it would have been okay. But a few years later, and by now he is an established guy in the community. He's in his 40s. He's not some young hothead. He's a middle-aged hothead. And he gets in an argument with his own military aide, which leads to a gunfight in the middle of a Nashville hotel where Jackson was shot again. And so he carried around those bullets for many, many years. I believe one of them eventually worked its way out or was extracted. Mm. But he was inaugurated as president with lead in his body.
I mean, it sounds like a teenager, doesn't it?
Yeah. A little more deadly, actually, than a lot of teenagers.
Indeed.
And just a very different time. And he was just a man who had a lot of strong, strong passions.
Well, John Ross is 1/8 Cherokee.
Yeah.
He chooses to be a Cherokee. Why?
Well, this is a fascinating decision, and I've heard it described as a heroic decision, because this is a guy who is in the Cherokee Nation at a time when they were trying to assimilate to white culture. And so they're adopting white man's clothes and the white man's education and white agricultural techniques. And he's got a Scottish father and grandfather who had been traders in the Cherokee Nation. And so he's an eloquent English speaker. He's a little educated, and he could pass as white, and sometimes did. So you could imagine a different reality for John Ross of just kind of obscuring his heritage a little bit and passing as white and going off into white society. Instead, he chose to stick with the group that was smaller, weaker, and seemingly destined to lose.
What does that tell us about John Ross?
I think it tells us that he had a strong sense of his own identity. He had a Scottish father and grandfather and so forth, but he was also the son and grandson of Cherokee women. And in Cherokee culture at that time, it was a matrilineal society. You traced ancestry through the mother and the grandmother. And it was a society where it was expected that you would marry outside your clan. The Cherokee Nation was divided into clans. And it was common that you would marry outside the tribe. And so intermarriage, as we think of it, was just normal. And in fact, very many white people had intermarried into the Cherokee Nation. And so they had no trouble accepting him as Cherokee. It was white people who had trouble with their kind of racial preoccupations at the time of getting their brains around this guy as a Cherokee. It was where he belonged, and it was part of his identity. And I can't help but suspect, although I cannot point to evidence, that when he, as a man who might be overlooked as white, heard how people dealt with people perceived as Indians, it offended him and perhaps offended his memory of his mother and his grandmother.
What's so interesting, you mentioned the War of 1812, Cherokees, including John Ross, fighting with the Americans, perhaps with the expectation that this young country would accept them either as part of their population, maybe give them a state.
Yeah.
I mean, they were a nation.
Yes. Well, that's the first thing to realize, which is hard to get your brain around. I knew as a kid, of course, that there were Indians when the European settlers came. But the legal concept that they owned specific chunks of land with borders that you could put on a map was relatively – I just kind of didn't get my brain around that as a kid. I think most people grow up and don't quite understand that. It was a separate nation of its own. And he is there trying to establish their identity and trying to find a place for the Cherokee Nation in this country. You're exactly right about the motivations of supporting the United States. They were also afraid. They were afraid that the United States would make a decision with some Indians uprising, well, either they're with us or against us, so the Cherokees better be with the United States. But after the war, John Ross, to me, did a fascinating thing. He became a Cherokee diplomat representing the Cherokee government in Washington. And he wrote a letter in which he said, "We consider ourselves a part of the great family of the Republic of the United States." He wasn't one of the Indian leaders who wanted out. He was an Indian leader who wanted in. And he did say, "We have distinguished ourselves by defending this country in war. Now give us our rights."
Yeah.
And John Ross actually used that argument in the process of the Cherokees winning a debate over land with Andrew Jackson.
There's an established nation here, the Cherokee Nation. And here's John Ross, who goes to the Supreme Court, who negotiates with Congress, who writes letters to the president. I mean, using all the kind of tools of democracy, and yet he gets, in many ways, he has some successes, but he is rebuffed.
Well, it's a defeat in the end.
Yes,
but he held out for more than 20 years and left quite a record that added, in my view, to our democratic tradition. And you're right that the institutions of the United States were such at that time, they were just being developed, that it was possible to avoid a Supreme Court ruling. John Marshall, probably the most influential Supreme Court justice, ruled in favor of the Cherokees in a case in 1832. And the effect of the ruling was simply that the Cherokees had the right to govern themselves on their land, that they had accepted the dominance of the United States but maintained sovereignty to themselves over a large chunk of real estate that covered parts of several states, and that the states involved, particularly the state of Georgia, did not have the right to tell them what to do. John Marshall ruled that. The state of Georgia never acknowledged the ruling. They didn't even send a lawyer to the Supreme Court to argue it. And President Jackson, Andrew Jackson was president by this time, denounced the ruling in a variety of different forums. But he did nothing for quite a number of months. And finally, his administration and its allies figured out a way to get the underlying case dropped. So the import of the ruling was never felt.
So Jackson signs the Indian Removal Act, and it was to, voluntarily, I'm using quotations here.
Thank you, yes.
Voluntarily allow the Indians to move on.
Yeah, it was to encourage them and to finance their transportation west to new land in what is now Oklahoma. It was not an order that they leave. In theory, the choice was still up to them. They would have to sign treaties with the United States to swap their land for land further out. But the pressure that came afterward made it clear that this was not really voluntary at all. White settlers wanted the land, and the U.S. government wasn't going to protect the Indians from white settlers.
What's so interesting is that John Ross seems to be driving Andrew Jackson crazy.
Yeah. Yeah.
With all the kind of negotiations and kind of roadblocks that he was putting into.
Yeah, no, I don't think it was that hard to drive Andrew Jackson crazy.
Probably not. Yes, based on his history,
getting
not so hard.
Getting back to the bullets.
Yes, exactly.
Again. But John Ross did. Andrew Jackson was a persistent and even stubborn man. John Ross was a persistent and even stubborn man. He was described, actually, he was criticized for being too stubborn. It can be argued, it was argued by many at the time, that he caused some of the catastrophe of the Trail of Tears by failing to just acknowledge defeat and prepare his people to move safely. Instead, they stayed where they were. But he did drive Andrew Jackson crazy. And when Ross finally won concessions at the end, Andrew Jackson wrote one of the greatest of his many great letters, and he's so angry he just keeps writing about that scamp Ross, as he calls him, until he runs out of paper. He doesn't even have room to punctuate at the end of the paper.
So how does John Ross end up? Where does he end up?
John Ross lived decades longer. He went with the bulk of his people, not quite all of them, to what is now Oklahoma, and the Cherokee Nation reestablished itself. It continues to be a sad and brutal story. I told you there was a minority faction that signed a treaty. There were a number of quite prominent Cherokee leaders, even including the editor of the newspaper that I just described to you, who signed this treaty. And they lived for a little while in Oklahoma with the rest of the Cherokee Nation, and then one day several of their leaders were simultaneously murdered. No one ever connected the murders to John Ross, but there had been a tradition among Cherokees that selling land in violation of the wishes of the people was an offense punishable by death. John Ross, however, remained the principal chief of the Cherokee Nation with some brief interruptions during the Civil War until his death in 1866.
Wow.
Attempted to remain loyal to the Union in the Civil War, even though the Cherokees, the majority of Cherokees at that moment seemed to favor the Confederacy, and many Cherokees fought on the Confederate side, as well as some on the Union side. And at the end of his life, Ross did a couple of things. He attended the second inaugural of Abraham Lincoln. He's got a quite memorable description of that. And he was, at the very end of his life, trying to renegotiate a new treaty to get the Cherokees back in good graces with the Union, which by then, of course, had won the war. And, of course, the price was what the price always was. The Cherokees could get back into good graces as long as they gave up some land.
So he never stopped believing somehow.
I don't think so.
It's extraordinary when you think about it.
No, I mean, there's a faith there that's touching. You come to think that maybe John Ross believed in American institutions more than some of the people who were in charge of the institutions.
Again, that was my conversation with NPR Morning Edition host Steve Inskeep about his book, Jackson Land, President Andrew Jackson, Cherokee Chief John Ross, and a Great American Land Grab. The conversation took place in front of an audience at Chestnut Hill College last summer. When we get back from the break, we'll listen to my conversation with veteran NPR reporter Susan Stamberg about her long life in radio. And you're listening to Radio Times in Review on WHYY. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We've been listening to my interviews with NPR's most familiar people, and we close out the hour by listening to my conversation with veteran NPR reporter Susan Stamberg. She's been working in public radio for more than 40 years and helped to shape the tone and style of NPR. She joined us in 2014 for a member event held at WHYY to discuss her life, her unlikely start working in radio, and some of her favorite moments in her storied career. Let's take a listen. When I say Susan Stamberg, people always mention your voice. I've mentioned your voice when I first heard you on the radio. Do you think of your voice when you think of yourself?
It's what I hear inside my head, but yeah. It's the result of happy, glorious, and late lamented years of smoking.
Is that true?
Oh, yes. Although I listen to some old tape for one reason or another now, and I don't hear that. I wasn't nearly so scratchy and husky, but that I suppose it's age that does that. It was more supple, certainly. That's a change. Watch out for it, Marty, when you get there. With age, you know, you lose your range a little bit.
I guess sounds like your first radio job was at WAMU.
It was.
You were the producer of a weekly
Yes,
show?
They brought, well, for the first job was for that, the potato quail, Don Quayle, and for that little network that he ran. And they hired me. I was at the New Republic, and I was bored to death, and called around and finally heard about this job. And the job was to be a producer for the Skinny Little Network of a weekly a news and public affairs show out of Washington, Washington-based. It was called Dateline Washington. And so I was hired for that. That was, there was no on-air work at all. It was all behind the scenes, deciding on subjects and lining up guests. And I was in a very good position. I must say, New Republic, for as boring as it was. And I was an excellent typist, by the way.
A good skill
and
to have.
And still am to this day, and when you don't have to be, you know. But I was quite good. But it there was a tremendous advantage to that, what became an extremely boring job, because doing it, I got to know, through who their writers were, who knew what about what. So I came in with sort of a Rolodex of experts to be able to call for this first radio program that I ever worked on. Viewpoint Washington, it was called.
Did you like working behind the scenes?
I loved it. Oh, I loved it, because, as I said, this was the glamour medium. So all of a sudden, look, a studio, look, a microphone, look how this works. It was fabulous. I loved it. And then here was my you want to hear the story of my
yes,
radio debut?
That was my next question, absolutely.
Okay, so that ended. That was had money from the Ford Foundation, was supporting that Skinny Little Network. And then the local station, which was very much like this, except it was on a university campus, which I don't believe is ever.
No, we're not.
This was always a city station, independent. Right. They hired me to continue in what turned out to be their brand new station as well. I was involved often as a pioneer, you know, just sort of bringing a station, helping to create it, as I did with National Public Radio. So they hired me to do a daily produce, again, behind the scenes, a daily show, which was, it turned out, the precursor of All Things Considered. It was a drive-time program. It was called Kaleidoscope. And I wrote the program and booked guests and all of this for the hosts. And here was my radio debut. One day, the weather girl got sick. And the format of the program was, you told the weather. So I looked around. There were no other possible weather girls. It was me and the host. So I thought, okay, I'll do the weather. And here's how we did it in these sophisticated days. You got on the telephone. You dialed WE21212. And you wrote down what the lady said on the other end. You carried that piece of paper into the studio, and you read it off. That was being the weather girl. But the day that my turn came, because the weather girl was sick, I was so nervous, I forgot to call. So I knew the time was coming. I knew to go in the studio. And then I thought, oh, my God, I have no idea what the weather is. And it was a closed studio. There were no windows. I couldn't even look out the window. So here's what I did. I made it up. It was February. I said it was 94 degrees. I made up the barometer. I made up all of this stuff. But the format was, you had to repeat it. But I was so nervous. I forgot what I'd said in the first place. So I made it up again. And luckily we had about two listeners, you know, and nobody called. But I'll tell you, it taught me a lot of basic important lessons. One was, you never go on the air unprepared. And two, you never lie to your listeners.
Yeah, yeah.
So I tried to, unlike you, a self-confessed liar, I tried to adhere to that for my life. But that's the glorious story.
You became the host in 72. The show began in 71.
Yeah, they were on the air. It was on the air for a while, mm-hmm. And I was hired there as a tape cutter. These were the days in which we had actual audio tape before there were digitalization.
Right.
And you cut tape with a razor blade and then put the ends took out what you didn't like and put the ends together with sticky tape. And that was what I was hired to do. Linda Wertheimer and I both began at that job. We came in pretty much the same time. And so I was doing that. Again, it was behind-the-scenes stuff, although it turned out I had more on-air experience than anybody else on the staff.
Wow.
Because I'd done
wow.
this daily program.
Giving the weather.
Oh, well, here's what happened. I did the weather for quite some time, actually, as I continued, because the weather girl, she didn't get sick. I think she graduated college. So I kept me on as weather girl. And then the guy I was writing it for, who was the host, left. So it befell me to become the host of that program. Wow. And so then I was doing a daily broadcast, and it was a great experience, and much more on-air experience than anybody else on the staff, on the first NPR staff had had.
I mean, so serendipitous, all of this, right?
Oh, absolutely. If only I planned. I know people with 5-year plans, 3-year plans, never. Yeah. I never had any of it. So I feel, you know, that was good. That was lucky.
Were you nervous? I mean, once you got this hosting gig, All Things Considered, and you were a pioneer. I mean, did you feel that? You were the first woman to...
Very much. And I remember that first time that I had to anchor that program. I was so nervous that I didn't eat lunch, which for me was quite a strange thing to be doing in those days. I couldn't, you know, it was too upsetting. But it really worked well, and they applauded me from the control room at the end of that. It was, I'll never forget that. It was very moving to me then. But still, I wasn't doing it right, and that took some time because there were no role models. The only thing you could hear to try to do the job were men. And so I was lowering my voice, and I was trying to sound very authoritative. And Bill Siemering said to me, "Be yourself. You don't need to do that. Be yourself." He had great confidence in me, and that helped me be easy and be what you hear on the air and what you hear now. No difference, really. I don't become another person sitting in a microphone. None of us do. That's the voice of public radio, by the way, is that way of communicating as if we were over the back fence, as if we're sitting talking to you now. No big, you know, orations.
Well, that is a perfect segue to something I want to play. This is an interview that goes back to November 11th, 1972.
What?
You are interviewing Arthur Rowe. He wrote a book called Radical Consumer. It was All Things Considered, November 11th, 1972. It's about 30 seconds.
Yeah.
It's just you introducing the segment or the guest. Let's listen to this.
I've had the experience of going to a local supermarket, buying a small bag of flour, taking it home, opening it up, and finding out that there were small ants and bugs in it. I know that as a responsible consumer, I should have taken it back to the store and demanded not only my money back, but that the store inform whoever the manufacturer was that the product was defective. But I guess my laziness overtook my sense of responsibility at that point, so I just dumped the flour out. I know that consumers are confronted by various sorts of defective products that they buy from time to time, and also that some new books are on the market now which help them not to be lazy.
What I like about that, I know, it's sort of crazy.
It's Arthur Rouse, wasn't it?
Oh, maybe it's, is it Rouse?
You went digging for this thing?
We dug all through your
Susan
past there.
Your Susan did this? Oh, my
Susan
goodness.
My Susan did this, yes, indeed. Susan
That's
Greenbaum.
That's astonishing.
But what I find so interesting about it is you're just talking to us.
I'm just talking.
You're not, we could be friends just sitting, waiting in the
yes.
checkout counter or something, talking about flour.
Yeah, that was the point, always. And that Bill enabled that, you know, he allowed that. But I was reading. So, you know, you didn't go on an ad lib. There were time constraints. So you needed to know how long the introduction would be and how much time you would have for the conversation, the interview itself. So I was reading.
Yeah.
But clearly I was reading in as conversational. I can't do that today, by the way. The dailiness gives you that. I bet that's why you do it. That's just how you sound. I know it. There's something that just makes you so loose for having to get out there every day. Now, because I'm not on every day, I do about a story a week, and I go in with a script. I have to tell myself, just talk it, Susan, just talk it. Because it's not the hardest thing is be solo on a radio. It really is. And to read well on a radio is about the toughest thing there is, to read naturally. So that, thank you for letting me hear that.
Well, we have more where that came from. In your book, Every Night at 5, you do say that Bill... A lot of people complained when you went on the air, and he kept that information from you. He did not share that with you.
Right.
Would that have upset you, do you think, if he had?
Oh, totally, and he knew it. He apparently, when I started, managers of stations, a number of them from around the country, called in to complain. They said, a woman's voice is not authoritative. People will not take her seriously. You can't have a female host. Now, part of it, because we were broadcasting, there were no satellites then, and we were broadcasting over telephone lines. And so, you know, the quality of that is not great, and it will emphasize the treble of a voice, but not so much the bass. Although I don't have much of a treble, whatever I had was amplified by that line. And so, to that extent, maybe they were right. But otherwise, Bill felt that that was incorrect. And, it was a measure of his leadership. He was quite an extraordinary man. I didn't find this out for 11 years.
I was reading somewhere as well that, I guess it was Scott Simon, said that during broadcasts, you would occasionally knit.
Oh, always.
Is that possible?
Yes, because I was trying to give up smoking. See, so
oh,
I ended up
with... Oh, there
you go. Yes, and so I needed to keep my hands busy. And so it was like Madame Defarge. I knitted my way through the Watergate.
Really?
I did. I just sat in there. Because you don't have much to do. You know, you do an introduction, and you're introducing somebody else's report, and it runs for 5 minutes. That's about three rows. And you put it down, you read the next.
Talk about
I was
multitasking.
Listening the whole time.
Yeah, but it worked, I guess.
You can't do it during breaking news.
You've spent, 42 years, something like that, at NPR?
Yeah.
Have you ever thought of what you might have done if you hadn't discovered radio or radio hadn't discovered you?
Oh, I probably would have worked on a newspaper or done publishing, book publishing, most likely. But I don't like to think about that because I'm so lucky.
Do you feel lucky?
Totally. I had some offers from television from time to time, and some of them were very nice. But nothing ever seemed as good to me because television's so specific. You know, our cliche is the pictures are always better on the radio.
Yeah.
In fact, they are because they're in your mind's eye, so we can look any way you want us to. And you can imagine a scene, and if we write it well enough, you really can visualize it. You can see it. But television, they'll always notice your hair's funny or, you've got a shadow on your face. It's just not nearly as interesting or expansive to me as radio.
I want to play another clip. This goes back to March 15th, 2003, right before the Iraq War.
Yeah.
And two House Republicans went ahead and changed the name of French fries to Freedom Fries.
Yeah.
In the House cafeteria, right. And here's Susan Stamberg singing on the radio and making fun of what was happening in the House of Representatives. Let's listen to this.
I love
Fresno
in the springtime. I love
Tempe
in the fall. I love
Paris Dubuque
in the winter when it drizzles. I love
Lubbock
in the summer when it sizzles.
If we take the daring plunge into three syllables, George Gershwin's classic could be changed to An American in Keokuk or Tallahassee or maybe even An American in Hackensack. Someday we hope there will be no war. The French and the Americans will come to their senses, effect a rapprochement, and begin sharing wine and hot dogs once again. In the meantime, as Bogey used to say, we'll always have Newark.
You were having fun. That was great. That was great.
I forgot that. You're incredible. Thank you.
Do you think it's possible to fake curiosity?
Well, one has bad days. You know this too.
Yes.
You have to fake enthusiasm sometimes and real interest when your stomach hurts or when your child is sick and your mind really isn't there when you do it a long time. But it's such a strong suit if in fact you're that way by nature. Don't you feel?
Yeah.
I do.
It doesn't feel good to fake it.
No, it doesn't at all. I had a friend in high school who used to hate to come to sleepovers at my house, she said, because I kept her up all night asking questions. And I do go through life like that. I certainly have done that. I am curious about most things. Fewer now as I get older. Maybe I know more, although I forget more, too. But, it's really genetic with me, I think.
Yeah.
That was my 2014 conversation with NPR's Susan Stamberg, taped at a member event at WHYY. And that wraps up this edition of Radio Times in Review. Radio Times is produced by Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, Liz Fiedler, and John Ahrens, who edits this show. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks for joining us, and have a great weekend.